Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. My kids and I were jonesing for a Gilmore Girls fix or an Alias fix the other night, and we surfed on to Extreme Makeover, which is a show where they give people who are severely lookistly challenged a number of different kinds of plastic surgery, and they do their hair, and they give them clothes advice, and they even give them jobs and laptops and all kinds of things. And then they have an unveiling, and everyone oohs and ahs over how extremely different they look. And they do look extremely different, and apparently, and they also give them a personal trainer and get them to lose weight or quit smoking or whatever. And apparently the people involved have a tremendous change in their personal self-esteem, and they're obviously profoundly moved by the transformation in themselves. But of course, this is seen as many indicative of the shallowness of American culture. So I was struck when my friend Simon Smith, the editor of Better Humans, recently wrote an editorial in praise of plastic surgery. Critics of cosmetic enhancement need an extreme makeover. And this is by Simon Smith, the editor of Better Humans magazine at betterhumans.com. And this was published last week. Fen Qian is a beauty queen. But admittedly, she had some help. A student of plastic surgery, the 22-year-old is the first winner of the Miss Artificial Beauty competition held recently in Beijing. Four operations to westernize her eyelids, suck out fat, sculpt her heart-shaped face, put her ahead of the 18 other contestants, including a transsexual and a 62-year-old pensioner. "I hope my win will make those who want to have surgery but don't dare to do it," says Feng, who wanted surgery both to increase her attractiveness and better understand her planned career. "Natural beauty and cosmetic surgery beauty are the same, and they should be recognized as that." Not everyone agrees. Certainly, plastic surgery is becoming more accepted, championed by such shows as The Swan and Extreme Makeover. Miss Artificial Beauty came about after model Yang Yuan was disqualified from another contest for having cosmetic surgery. She sued the organizers and lost, but they were inspired to create a pageant showcasing that which they previously had disapproved. Despite such endorsement, however, growing interest and participation in cosmetic enhancement has been met by rising rhetoric from those who question its use, its role in society, and the impact it might have should trends continue. The issue unites enemies in disapproval while attracting few defenders. Advocates of body modification, for example, often deride plastic surgery as a tool for shaping everyone into mainstream society's beauty ideal. Piercing, scarring, and tattooing exist in part to give mainstream beauty the finger. Meanwhile, advocates of human enhancement, with the notable exception of James Watson, who has argued that it would be great if all women were pretty, shy away from defending cosmetic enhancement. Leading American bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, for example, who favors human enhancement, recently wrote, "Augmenting breasts or prolonging erections may be vain and even a waste of scarce resources, but seeking to use our knowledge to enhance our vision, memory, learning skills, immunity, or metabolism is not obviously either." Now, I'm not suggesting that bigger breasts trump better memory, but I also don't think that cosmetic enhancement deserves to be a punching bag for both the pro- and anti-enhancement camps. What's wrong with wanting to be physically attractive? And what's wrong with providing as many people as possible the means to achieve it? Arguments against cosmetic enhancement tend to dance around these questions, attacking such things as the risk of techniques and the tragedy of the common scenarios, such as a world in which nobody is ever beautiful enough. These arguments are merely diversions because they can be addressed separately from the core issue. It's time that defenders of the inequitable status quo dealt with the real questions head on, because there's nothing inherently wrong with people wanting to be beautiful, and much good in making beauty more widely available. Of course, this immediately raises the question, what is beauty? I don't intend to get sidetracked into this morass, but an answer is important for a discussion of cosmetic enhancement. So for this argument, I'll simply define beauty as that which physiology and culture predispose people to find appealing. Evolution, as Nancy Etkoff shows in Survival of the Prettiest, has shaped both our physical appearance and the template of what we find attractive. Babies just a few hours old choose to stare at attractive faces over unattractive. But culture, as Naomi Wolf famously argues in The Beauty Myth, fills in the blanks. Yes, companies exploit the desire for beauty to sell products, but the beauty being promoted isn't a myth, merely an enhanced image of what humans are hardwired to find attractive, with the enhancement serving a profit-making purpose. Given that biology plays such a large role in what we find beautiful, it's no surprise that tremendous advantage accrue to the attractive. An oft-cited 1993 study by economists Daniel Hammermesh and Jeff Biddle found that unattractive people earn less than average-looking people, who in turn earn less than attractive people. Unattractiveness was found to have 5 to 10% impact on earnings. The effects were found to be slightly greater for men than women, but unattractive women were found less likely to be part of the labor force at all. And besides improving your job prospects, being attractive could also save your life. In Survival of the Prettiest, Etkoff discusses a study in which college-age men were more likely to donate a kidney to a woman, swim 1 mile to rescue her, save her from a burning building, or jump on a hand grenade for her if she were attractive rather than unattractive. All in all, there's little doubt that beauty has deep biological roots, nor that it confers advantages. On these points, both advocates and detractors of cosmetic enhancement tend to agree. The difference lies in how they propose that we best address inequities in the distribution of beauty. Advocates propose democratization through technology and the marketplace. Detractors argue against this, mainly on the grounds that desiring to be beautiful is a moral flaw, that altering the body to make it more attractive is unnatural, that alterations pose risks to individuals, and that wide adoption of such alterations would have a negative overall impact on society. Do any of these arguments hold up to scrutiny? Let's start with the moral inferiority argument. Debating this issue recently with a friend in a Toronto bar, I goaded him, like the three-year-old, to answer the question, why is plastic surgery wrong? Why? He eventually responded to the effect, because it makes me sad to think that I'd live in a world where everyone only cared about their beauty. In her analysis, The Democratization of Beauty, New Atlantis senior editor Christine Rosen puts forward a similar position, decreeing that what used to be encouraged, a lifelong process of moral education, is less useful in the long term than the appearance of success, health, and beauty. This moral inferiority argument is flawed. First, it sets up the false dichotomy that people who want to be beautiful are necessarily less moral and less interested in pursuing other means of self-improvement. While many of the people whose surgical alterations are commonly flaunted in the media, mostly actors and actresses, often of dubious acting achievement, may indeed be narcissistic, it does not mean that every person seeking cosmetic enhancement is so. There's no reason why someone can't be gorgeous as Cindy Crawford while being as moral as Gandhi and as intelligent as Einstein. Millions of people get plastic surgery every year. Are they all morally inferior? Second, it suggests that moral education can and should overcome hardwired biological urges. As the history of Catholic priests attest, even the strictest of moral prescriptions fails in the face of such urges. Certainly, we can discuss biological interventions, say, castration, to remove the urges, but I see no reason why such physiological alterations would be more ethical than physiological alterations to make people more beautiful in the first place. Third, no outside person should be able to dictate another person's appropriate level of suffering before they are entitled to cosmetic enhancement. If someone feels that they are suffering because of their appearance and psychological analysis rules out underlying disorders, then that person should not face the scrutiny of outsiders who question their pain with the goal of curtailing their access to valid means of treatment or enhancement, call it what you will. Furthermore, it's not clear why wanting to have a physically attractive body is worse than wanting to have physically attractive things around us. Certainly, those who decry the growth in plastic surgery don't argue that wanting to own and create beautiful objects, a gorgeous sculpture, say, or a beautiful painting, or even a well-decorated house, is bad. These things can enrich our lives and offer avenues of self-expression. So why do the arguments change when we talk about making ourselves more beautiful rather than the objects that surround us? The only conclusion we can draw is that somehow plastic surgery's detractors see the body as different from other kinds of objects. Only by sanctifying the body can they hold that it's good to want to create beautiful non-body objects, but not good to want to create beautiful bodies. Certainly, some people might argue that desiring beauty in anything represents repugnant materialism. But this stoicism is rarely espoused alongside arguments against cosmetic enhancement. The target is not taking pleasure in beautiful things, but in wanting a more beautiful body, specifically. But if we believe that desiring beauty rather than ugliness in objects is good, and that the human body is nothing more than an object with which we're intimately attached, then I fail to see how we can conclude that wanting to be beautiful is morally bankrupt. As for the argument that cosmetic enhancement is unnatural, it's a dead end. Besides suffering from the usual irrationality of arguments from nature, it ignores the fact that what's natural is for humans to alter their body. In Fresh Lipstick, Redressing Fashion and Feminism, for instance, author Linda Scott points out that people in every culture and throughout history have groomed and decorated themselves for many reasons, including, but not exclusively, sexual attraction. While many feminists have advocated a more natural appearance, she says, what's natural is for people to alter their appearance. As is the case with today's plastic surgery detractors, natural for feminists has often been simply counterposed to whatever the prevailing fashion found attractive, says Scott. What about the risks of plastic surgery for individuals and society? Here, in my opinion, are some potentially valid concerns. Certainly, the physical dangers of some procedures are a concern. Certainly, body dysmorphic Michael Jackson syndrome is a concern. Certainly, the most perverting tendencies of capitalism to create feelings of inadequacy are a concern. Certainly, the pressure exerted on non-surgery recipients is increased when others are getting nips and tucks and they're not. Certainly, wealthier people being able to make themselves more beautiful and thereby reap the rewards of enhanced beauty and become wealthier is a concern. Although Rosen, quoting various sources, notes that just 23% of plastic surgery patients come from families earning more than $50,000 per year. But these concerns can be addressed without banning cosmetic enhancement or terrorizing those who want a beauty upgrade. Rather, growing legitimization of cosmetic enhancement and a growing market can lead to improvements in procedure effectiveness, safety, and affordability. Regulations can ensure the enforcement of such things as psychological screening and adherence to strict ethical guidelines. And concerns about inequality are best addressed by improving, rather than restricting, access insurance policies and universal health plans, for instance, which could expand their coverage for elected procedures. As for creating feelings of inadequacy, a possible approach to this problem is regulating cosmetic enhancement marketing in the same way as drug marketing is regulated in many jurisdictions today. This probably wouldn't entirely curtail the pressure to conform, but this pressure extends beyond cosmetic enhancement. To take the most extreme example, just look at the body modification community, where modifications such as tongue splitting become trendy in the same way as Botoxing parties. Are these perfect solutions? Of course not. They only scratch the surface. But they show that we can address the risks of cosmetic enhancement while encouraging its development and use. I think that most critics recognize this, but are driven by squeamishness, sucking fat out of the body is yucky, and fear, plastic surgery frightens me, but if everyone gets it, I might have to as well. I can't help but think that if beauty pills come on the market tomorrow, detractors would soon pop them without thought in the same way that life extensions detractors pop vitamins today. In winning the first artificial beauty contest, Keon may very well have furthered the acceptance of cosmetic enhancement. But a bigger success will be when we no longer need separate events to distinguish artificial from natural beauty. And perhaps an even bigger success will be the end of pageants as we know them, when a sliver of humanity no longer has a monopoly on comeliness and beauty is available to all. That was the article, In Praise of Plastic Surgery, Critics of Cosmetic Enhancement Need an Extreme Makeover, by Simon Smith, the editor of Better Humans magazine, at betterhumans.com. When you're thinking about things like tsunamis and protecting the Earth from asteroids, and you believe that life extension may eventually allow us all to live a very, very long time, one of the questions that comes up is about this phrase immortalism. Is it really possible for anybody to think about the prospect of being immortal, to escape the eventual constraints of the physical universe and live a truly immortal life? And I don't really think it's very possible, given the accident rate and a number of other philosophical challenges to the notion of what it really would mean for an individual to be immortal. But some people are thinking about what we might do as a race, as a intelligent life in the universe, to escape the apparent limit of intelligent life in this universe, which is the heat death of the universe or its eventual collapse of some kind. And one of the people who's thinking about that is Michio Kaku, who is a physicist at Columbia University, and he's the author of many books, and he has his own radio show. And in his latest book, he offers a method of escaping from the heat death of the universe. And he's summarized his argument in an article in Prospect Magazine, the British magazine called Prospect Magazine. It's a prospectmagazine.co.uk. And his article is Escape from the Universe, February 2005 issue of Prospect Magazine. And I'm going to read you a little bit of that. The universe is out of control in a runaway acceleration. Eventually, all intelligent life will face the final doom, the big freeze. An advanced civilization must embark on the ultimate journey, fleeing to a parallel universe. In Norse mythology, Ragnarok, the fate of the gods, begins when the Earth is caught in the vice-like grip of bone-chilling freeze. The heavens themselves freeze over as gods perish in great battles with evil serpents and murderous wolves. Eternal darkness settles over the bleak, frozen land, as the sun and moon are both devoured. Odin, the father of all gods, finally falls to his death, and time comes itself to a halt. Does this ancient tale foretell our future? Ever since the work of Edwin Hubble in the 1920s, scientists have known that the universe is expanding, but most have believed that the expansion was slowing as the universe aged. In 1998, astronomers at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and the Australian National University calculated the expansion rate by studying dozens of powerful supernova explosions within distant galaxies, which can light up the entire universe. They could not believe their own data. Some unknown force was pushing the galaxies apart, causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. Brian Schmidt, one of the group leaders, said, "I was still shaking my head, but we had checked everything. I was very reluctant to tell people because I truly thought that we were going to get massacred." Physicists went scrambling back to their blackboards and realized that some dark energy of unknown origin, akin to Einstein's cosmological constant, was acting as an anti-gravity force. Apparently, empty space itself contains enough repulsive dark energy to blow the universe apart. The more the universe expands, the more dark energy there is to make it expand even further, leading to an exponential runaway mode. In 2003, this astonishing result was confirmed by the WMAP, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe satellite. Orbiting at 1 million miles from Earth, this satellite contains 2 telescopes capable of detecting the faint microwave radiation which bathes the universe. It's so sensitive that it is able to photograph in exquisite detail the afterglow of the microwave radiation left over from the Big Bang, which is still circulating in the universe. The WMAP satellite, in effect, gave us baby pictures of the universe when it was a mere 380,000 years old. The WMAP satellite settled the long-standing question of the age of the universe. It is officially 13.7 billion years old, to within 1% accuracy. But more remarkably, the data showed that dark energy is not a fluke, but makes up 73% of the matter and energy of the entire universe. To deepen the mystery, the data showed that 23% of the universe consists of dark matter, a bizarre form of matter which is invisible but still has weight. Hydrogen and helium make up 4%, while the higher elements, you and I included, make up just 0.3%. Dark energy and most of dark matter do not consist of atoms, which means that contrary to what the ancient Greeks believed and what is taught in every chemistry course, most of the universe is not made of atoms at all. As the universe expands, its energy content is diluted and temperatures eventually plunge to near absolute zero, where even atoms stop moving. One of the iron laws of physics is the second law of thermodynamics, which states that in the end, everything slows down, that the total entropy or disorder or chaos in the universe always increases. This means that iron rusts, our bodies age and crumble, empires fall, stars exhaust their nuclear fuel, and the universe itself will run down as temperatures drop uniformly to near zero. Charles Darwin was referring to this law when he wrote, "Believing as I do that man is in the distant future will be a far more perfect creature than he is now, it is an intolerable thought that he and all other sentient beings are doomed to complete annihilation after such long, continued, slow progress." And one of the most depressing passages in the English language was written by Bertrand Russell, who described the unyielding despair he felt when contemplating the distant future. "No fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought or feeling can preserve a life beyond the grave. All the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday blightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system, and the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins." Russell wrote this passage in an era before space travel, so the death of the sun does not seem so catastrophic today, but the death of the entire universe seems inescapable. So on some day in the far future, the last star will cease to shine, and the universe will be littered with nuclear debris, dead neutron stars, and black holes. Intelligent civilizations, like homeless people in rags huddled next to dying campfires, will gather around the last flickering embers of black holes emitting a faint Hawking radiation. Although thermodynamics and cosmology point to the eventual death of all life forms in the universe, there is still one loophole. It is a law of evolution that when the environment changes radically, life must adapt, flee, or die. The first alternative seems impossible. The last is undesirable. And this leaves us with one choice. Leave. Leave the universe. Although the concept of leaving our dying universe is to enter another seems utterly mad, there is no law of physics forbidding entering a parallel universe. Einstein's general relativity theory allows for the existence of wormholes or gateways connecting parallel universes, sometimes called Einstein-Rosen bridges. But it is still unknown whether quantum corrections make such a journey possible or not. Although once considered a preposterous idea, the concept of the multiverse, that our universe consists with an infinite number of parallel universes, has recently generated much interest among physicists from several directions. First, the leading theory consistent with the WMAP data is the inflationary theory proposed by Alan Guth of MIT in 1979. It postulates a turbocharged expansion of the universe at the beginning of time. The inflationary universe idea neatly explains several stubborn cosmological mysteries, including the flatness and uniformity of the universe. But since physicists still do not know what drove this rapid inflationary process, there remains the chance that it could happen again in an endless cycle. This is the chaotic inflationary idea of Andre Lind of Stanford University, in which parent universes bud baby universes in a continuous, never-ending cycle. Like soap bubbles which split into two smaller bubbles, universes can constantly sprout from other universes. But what caused the Big Bang and drove this inflation? The question remains unanswered. Since the Big Bang was so intense, we have to abandon Einstein's theory of general relativity, which forms the underlying framework for all of cosmology. Einstein's theory of gravity breaks down at the instant of the Big Bang and hence cannot answer the deep philosophical and theological questions raised by the event. At these incredible temperatures, we must incorporate quantum theory and the other great theory to emerge in the 20th century, which governs the physics of the atom. Quantum theory and Einstein's relativity theory are opposites. The former governs the world of the very small, the peculiar subatomic realm of electrons and quarks. Relativity theory rules the world of the very large, of black holes and expanding universes. Relativity, therefore, is not suited to explaining the instant of the Big Bang, where the universe was smaller than a subatomic particle. At this moment, we would expect radiation effects to dominate over gravity, and hence we need a quantum description of gravity. Indeed, one of the greatest challenges facing physics is to unify these theories into a single coherent theory of all the forces in the universe. Physicists today are groping for this theory of everything. Many proposals have been made over the past half century, but all have been shown to be inconsistent or incomplete. So far, the leading, in fact, the only candidate, is string theory. The latest incarnation of string theory, M theory, may answer a question which has dogged advocates of higher dimensions for a century. Where are they? Smoke can expand and fill up an entire room without vanishing into hyperspace. So, higher dimensions, if they exist at all, must be smaller than an atom. If higher dimensional space were larger than an atom, then we would see atoms mysteriously drifting and disappearing into a higher dimension, which we do not see in the laboratory. In the older string picture, one had to curl up or wrap up 6 of the 10 original dimensions, leaving the 4-dimensional universe of today. These unwanted dimensions are squeezed into a tiny ball called a Calaubi-Yau manifold, too small to be seen. But M-theory adds a new twist to this. Some of these higher dimensions can be large or even infinite in size. Imagine 2 parallel sheets of paper. If an ant lived on each sheet, each would think that its sheet was the entire universe, unaware that there was another universe close by. In fact, the other universe would be invisible. Each ant would live out its life oblivious to the fact that another universe was only a few inches away. Similarly, our universe may be a membrane floating in 11th dimensional hyperspace, while we remain oblivious of the parallel universes hovering nearby. One interesting version of M-theory cosmology is the ekpyriadic, from the Greek for conflagration, universe, proposed by Paul Steinhardt, Bert Overoot, and Neil Turok. It assumes that our universe is a flat, infinite membrane floating in a higher dimensional space. But occasionally, gravity attracts a nearby membrane. These two parallel universes race towards each other until they collide, releasing a colossal amount of energy, the Big Splat. This explosion creates our known universe and sends the two parallel universes flying apart in hyperspace. And I'm going to have to stop reading his article there before you get to the exciting conclusion of how all of these physics experiments and facts lead to the eventual escape from our dying universe. So I urge you to read the article yourself and read Michio Kaku's book. The article is Escape from the Universe. It's in prospectmagazine.co.uk. And check out Michio Kaku's latest book, Parallel Worlds. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my change surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.